when I was a kid. Guys like me were brought up to follow codes.
Hey, jerk off.
What'd you say?
What?
Antonio Soprano.
I wonder if I can talk to you alone for a moment, Mrs. Soprano. On the basis of the Sanford-Binet, he's high IQ.
You can't prove it by me. He's got a D plus average.
Well, he doesn't apply himself, but he is smart. The results tell us. He's a leader.
Uncle Dick.
Growing up with the family takes a toll.
Maybe an ambassador to England or France.
You're my nephew. Might like to gamble. I want to do whatever I can to help you. You may
be a businessman. My gift to you.
I want to go to college. I can't get caught with shit like this.
Look, you take the speakers, right? At the same time, you say to yourself, this is the last time I'm ever going to steal something. It's that simple.
Let me go talk to him.
He only listens to Dickie.
Gotta do something about Dickie Malasani.
As far as your nephew goes,
I'm listening.
Stay out of his life.
Arriving October 1st in theaters and on HBO Max, New Line Cinema's The Many Saints of Newark is a feature film prequel to David Chase's influential HBO crime drama, The Sopranos. The movie was shot on location in New York and New Jersey, with a cast including Alessandro Nivola, Leslie Odom Jr., John Bernthal, Corey Stoll, Ray Liotta, and Vera Farmiga. The teenage Tony Soprano is played by Michael Gandolfini, son of James Gandolfini, the original Tony. Joining us in this episode are director of photography Kramer Morgenthau and production designer and Sopranos alum Bob Shaw. Shaw is an Emmy winner for Boardwalk Empire and Mad Men and received 3 additional nominations for his work on The Sopranos. He was also Oscar nominated for Martin Scorsese's The Irishman. Morgenthau is a 6-time Emmy nominee whose credits include Game of Thrones, Boardwalk Empire, Thor: The Dark World, Creed 2, and recent release Respect. I'm Carolyn Giardina. Welcome to the Hollywood Reporter's Behind the Screen. Bob Kramer, welcome. Thanks for joining us. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So, Bob, for you, what was it like to return to the Sopranos world?
It was less like returning to the Sopranos world than delving into the Sopranos history. There were names and characters that had always been sort of sprinkled through the dialogue in the series, like Chicky Sasso. We always heard about Chicky Sasso getting shot. And so it was interesting to sort of take a little trip into the history that I knew a little bit about, but not everything.
And Kramer, what was it like for you joining?
For me as a cinematographer, it was a dream project, you know, working on a 1960s gangster movie. It's a dream come true. Also, I felt a lot of weight because there were big shoes to fill, because the show was such a beautiful piece of work and such a piece of iconic, Americana at this point.
So this was shot entirely in New York and New Jersey. Bob, why don't you start? Tell us about scouting and, you know, how you picked some of the key locations in this film.
Well, it's interesting. We first went and looked at the neighborhood in Newark where things would have really taken place, and found that it was a little too changed. And all of the houses were covered with vinyl siding, and they all had replacement windows and different alterations over time. And we then started looking for neighborhoods that looked a little bit more like Newark would have looked. And we found ourselves in the Bronx. And partially, I had done a film a couple of years ago where we shot almost all in the Bronx. And there are certain neighborhoods that haven't changed. They still have the same, those metal awnings that are over top of the doors and windows. You know, so they've been there in these neighborhoods in the Bronx for 50 years, and no one's ever taken them down. And Newark was much more single-family houses had been clearly altered, and we took a little bit to convince David that we could not do it in New Jersey. But what wasn't New Jersey looked more like New Jersey at the time period.
Did some of the work you did researching for The Irishman help here?
You know, to a certain extent, and to a certain extent, it was the same thing as The Irishman, where it happened to be territory that I was familiar with from family background. I mean, I grew up in New Jersey, and I remember turning the local TV stations on, you know, WPIX and WOR, and seeing coverage of the riots when they were happening. And so I, in both instances, I sort of relied on my mother's Italian family background and my own New Jersey background.
Kramer, what was the overall look that you talked about with the with your director and the filmmakers initially that you wanted to create?
I think the overall look that we were going for with Alan Taylor, our director, and David Chase, creator of the show and the writer and the producer, was something that was super cinematic and at the same time honored the original look of the show, but had maybe a more of a big screen, larger than life quality, and yet at the same time staying immersive with these characters. I didn't want it to feel like something like film noir. I wanted it to feel like something more like a naturalism, that you know, that you actually are in these worlds. And you know, we did deep research into, you know, photographic research into what the North Ward, which was the Italian neighborhood, would have looked like at the time, and you know, what it would feel like to be in these row houses. Kind of the claustrophobia of that, and you know, needing to get out of the so-called, you know, I don't know, Italian ghetto, for lack of a better word, and using a widescreen aspect ratio, which kind of allowed, you know, an ensemble of all these amazing characters to kind of line up in a row, almost like a, you know, some sort of Dutch master painting, that kind of thing.
To what extent did the series influence your decisions, although obviously it was a different period?
Photographically, and sort of as a filmmaker, the show, you know, had an influence. There was a, you know, a deep dive into use of top light and sort of, you know, kind of, I think, a reference to Godfather 1 and 2 and Gordon Willis's work are kind of like the holy grail of any American gangster movie made after, you know, 1970. So it's impossible not to be influenced by that work. And, you know, heavy use of contrast and chiaroscuro, and but also a way of shooting characters where you shoot a two shot and you allow the two characters to play in the frame, and not, you know, kind of a more modern approach where you're constantly cutting to close up to close up to, you know, coverage over, and, you know, a more cutty approach. It's a much more staid and just allow people to breathe, you know, allow characters to breathe, allow the audience to breathe, allow people to take in Bob Shaw's beautiful production design and the costume design and the environments that you're in. And the environment is almost as much of a character as is the characters themselves. You know, it's like we're visiting a world, we're visiting, you know, the origin story of where how these guys wound up in suburbia and their urban roots. So there you have it.
The white ratio is like very important, because back at the time we were doing the show, certainly in the early years, there was a little bit of a struggle to get permission to show it in a wide format. And in the first couple of seasons, it was always well, you can do it that way, but you have to protect for the normal TV aspect ratio, which would mean instead of having people at the far end of the frame, they wanted them in the middle anyway. But the show always featured what I always called the Last Supper shot and these wide tableaus. And so once that struggle was finally won and we could just shoot in the wide aspect ratio, it became part of the style of the show. So the fact of doing that again with the film is very much stylistically, you know, Sopranos.
Let's talk about some of the scenes. Let's start with the 1967 Newark riots. Bob, this was shot in Newark. Do you want to talk about how you selected the over the few blocks that you used for that set?
When we decided to scout Newark, and we scouted some other cities in New Jersey, the area we were in had the most concentrated number of storefronts that we could alter. We weren't going to be able to find anything in the commercial world that had not changed in all this time. But a lot of it was about control, and there were three blocks that we could control and stores that were willing for us, you know, to transform them and shut them down. And part of it was the, I forget the name of the deli that featured in a lot of shots.
It was Hobby's Deli?
Hobby's, yeah. That was there, and the old movie theater was there. So those were sort of the anchors, and then most of the rest of it was altered. But it was altered in a practical way because there was so much action taking place and fire and smoke and atmosphere that there was no way that it could be done anything other than practically. So control and having the ability to close somebody down for 3 weeks was important.
And then I would imagine there was also a lot of post-production work involved, not just in that, but across the board, to take out anything that was more modern for the period.
You know, this was done a lot more practically than things I'd worked on, you know, of late, just because of the smoke and the fire and so many people running in front of the stores. Some stuff higher up was altered, but down on the street, everything really needed to be practical in this case.
Shooting the Newark riots was one of the great challenges of shooting Many Saints of Newark, and we have so many different sort of takes on how to approach it. We just wanted to, you know, do it as sensitively as possible and not to glorify it or, you know, fetishize the violence or the, you know, the rebellion is really what it was. And we, you know, did a very deep dive into archival footage of the actual event and all the photojournalism around it. And it's a very careful study, and hopefully we got part of it right anyway. We shot with Panavision lenses, which were T-series anamorphic lenses that were tuned in such a way to kind of have a bit of a period feeling to them, and we used Aeroflex large format cameras.
And I believe you also did some grain and manipulation in post-production.
Yeah, we used something called live grain, which is a way that it's kind of scans of real film grain. Peter Doyle, a colorist, did a bunch of lookup table work to kind of do film emulation and that kind of thing.
Kramer, tell us about your approach to lighting the actors.
The lighting of the actors was a much more naturalistic approach I was taking than maybe some of the other stuff I've done before, or even what you might expect in a gangster type movie, using a lot of top light, a lot of directional but more subtler, softer approach, and just something that would bring these characters to life and kind of heighten some of the moments that we're seeing them go through some of the violence, some of the, you know, more emotional story points.
Specifically, would you talk about lighting Michael Gandolfini?
Yeah, Michael, we wanted to, you know, light him in a certain way that made him look younger in the, you know, when he first appears, and then kind of as he kind of starts to find his truth in the story, you know, give him a little bit more of a kind of tougher quality, and maybe sort of shaped him more, and let some of his foreshadowing of who he's going to become as Tony Soprano come through later on.
For nearly four decades, JMK Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started JMK Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. JMK Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com.
Let's talk about some of the other actors. Would you like to describe working with Vera Farmiga, who played Livia?
Vera was really, you know, an incredible actor to work with. And I remember this was pre-COVID, and I was able to, you know, bring my family to set. And my daughter, who was about 4 years old at the time, saw her lying in bed. She's like, what's she doing in bed, what's she doing there? And you know, I said, oh, she's acting. She said, oh, she's acting, I want to be an actress. It's kind of a maybe slightly off topic story, but it was a just a memory I had of Vera, and she completely inhabited that role and was wearing a prosthetic nose to make her look more like the original Livia, and she just kind of transformed into, you know, a whole nother person that was just completely in that whole world, and you couldn't shake her out of it. She was like kind of went full on.
What about working with Corey Stroll as Junior?
You know, again, a very serious actor, and had really obviously studied everything that Junior was, and you kind of felt like you were, you know, watching the same character 40 years in advance. It was really, again, transformational. I mean, this cast is like, you know, some of the great actors that are out there today. Really a pleasure.
Bringing some of those iconic characters back at their younger ages must have been quite a challenge for all of you.
Yeah, you know, it was, we did a lot of tests with them and with their hair and their makeup and, you know, the right glasses, Corey, and you know, part of what we do as cinematographers is help bring the characters to life, and you know, the great actors understand how much cinematography is a part of their characters' portrayal, and they love to get involved in the collaboration and really understand how light and the right angle and you know, the right lens is can make all the difference in how they're brought to the screen.
Bob, in this film, you also had to create the scene at Playland when Tony's father, Johnny Boy, is arrested. Would you talk about creating that setting, since that was also referenced in the series?
It was referenced in the series. It was smaller in scope in the series. We went to Rye Playland because it's an amusement park, which really, for the most part, is old style, and things are wooden, and it had the right look. But we were able to give it a bigger scope than that was done in the series, and so we didn't feel compelled to try and recreate what had been in the series. We tried to do what was the best for this script, sort of coming to a cold, as opposed to, you know, feeling the need we had to recreate the pork store, but not feeling we had to recreate the amusement park.
And then you also have a scene set at Holston's, the restaurant where the final scene of the series takes place. Would you talk about going back to that setting, which I believe is in Bloomfield, New Jersey?
Yeah. Well, one thing that was handy was that the people who own Holston's have owned it for a long time, and they were able to provide us with some photographs of what it looked like back in the day, as they say, and the awnings that were on it and how the signage was different. So it's the same location as in the last scene in the series, but It's how it looked 30, 40 years ago. There were awnings in the front. There was signage in the front. I mean, we were looking at these pictures with magnifying glasses, literally trying to figure out what the objects in the window were. And so we really didn't do that much other than some changes of signage and some and the awnings that were there. Awnings were a big thing at the time still, you know, and they didn't have these plastic awnings that they put on stores now.
Kramer, do you want to talk about shooting that scene? I mean, that the location in the original obviously has become so iconic.
Yeah, I mean, shooting the scene is a, you know, again, it's like taking a piece of Americana and, you know, having the honor of photographing it. The restaurant itself is kind of stands alone. It's a timepiece in the middle of a block in Bloomfield, New Jersey. That nothing around it really feels like of the era. So when we looked out the window at Tony, young Tony, sort of standing there in this sort of lone figure silhouette looking out the window, nothing out there was really period correct. So we had to put a giant blue screen in one direction and then use a plate of a background from just maybe about just sort of half a block away that Bob had dressed. And the inside of the restaurant really felt like you were back in the 70s. And there's kind of like layers of kind of texture that are there. And then Bob, who is a, you know, genius of many kinds, but of detail and, you know, making sure everything in the shot is right, that you could kind of photographic, and it feel when you, as soon as you're pointing the camera, you feel like you're going back in time. It was kind of it was magical, you know.
I think the Silhouette Club was a real collaboration because we knew it was going to be very dimly lit and there wouldn't be any reason to have like a lot of bright light in there. And something has changed so much since the era when we started The Sopranos, is, you know, shooting digitally and with the cameras, you rely a lot more on your practical lights. And so we were building as many things into the set as we could in the performing area where the singer was in the Silhouette Club. We've added those sort of large round lights to the ceiling, and we did some tests, you know, of just what to make them out of to make sure that they were sort of had the right amount of presence and were a graphic element but weren't too bright or too distracting. And we built a lot of the lighting into the set, you know, behind the little stage where the singer was, and then in the room where they are eating the sheep's heads in the back. Again, we did as many little light tricks as we could to justify that something would be on for the scene where Dickie goes back into the club looking for his gun. And to be able to see, but be able to not have it be implausible. So I think that was one where we really had to collaborate a lot on just how much light we needed and what kind of fixtures we wanted to achieve it with. Exterior and interior were two different places. They were both, it was funny because the location that was the Silhouette Club was actually the Danish Sports Club. Now, no one would even know that there was such a thing as a Danish Sports Club, but it was sort of a social club. From an earlier era, and we liked the bar, and the bar was a little piece of the right time period, but then we really had to change pretty much everything else. And at one point we were going to have split the front room where the entertainment was and the back room into two different places, and then we came up with a way to sort of build a set that connected to, so the front room was partially intact when we found it, and then we added walls to it, and then we added a whole set that was completely from scratch, you know, through the doorway.
Built a set into a set into a location. It's just like it's incredible. Like, you know, I was like, you're what? And it was just, it all felt like it was, you know, actually part of what was there, but it was like some of it was elements of a location, some of it were set pieces. Then he built another room that you go into, and it was, you know, it's kind of, and they're like these incredibly low ceilings, and I have to do a scene in there with no light, you know, it's the lights of power has gone out because, you know, one of the characters has shut off the lights because they're chasing each other. And I'm like, Bob, how do I light the darkness? And the ceilings are too low to hide movie lights. So we collaborated and built these round fixtures that look like they're supposed to be there. And that can go from looking like tungsten lights to looking like kind of moonlightish stuff. And it was like it was a great collaboration.
And then the outside was chosen because we needed the outside to work for the action and the shooting and the cars, you know, and all of that. It just had nothing to do with where we were.
But it was a real, again, it was like a real club, or was it a funeral home?
It was a German club. We were going to different older clubs in New York, and it was in Astoria, or was it in?
It was in Brooklyn.
It was in Brooklyn.
And one thing about shooting in the outer boroughs, and Bob's genius is that he find, you know, that architecture in the outer boroughs of Manhattan has not changed, you know, and it has to do with, you know, economics of these neighborhoods. They have not been gentrified. And he goes out and just drags a fine-tooth comb through all these neighborhoods and finds these gems that haven't changed. And, you know, there was not a lot that needed to be changed. I mean, you changed the facade, but it was a real facade. And then the buildings around feel like you are in Newark in 1967 or, you know, whatever the exact date was. But it's like, it's part of it is finding, you know, the architecture that's, you know, a diamond in the rough out there.
The surrounding buildings drove the location choice more than the facade of the club. And Alan had some very specific blocking in mind. And we would get out and scout somewhere and Alan would go, you know, we'd wait for him to figure out whether the geometry worked for him.
The storyboard, he had drawn storyboards, so we had to find locations. And Alan has this thing where he's with his fingers and he's kind of looking at where the characters line up and how the eye line and if it's going to fit in his location. And then he actually redrew the storyboards once you found that great location.
It's funny that when Alan goes to a location, you're looking around and it's like, where did he go? And you look and he's like, standing on top of a fence because he wants a high angle. And it's like, he hasn't killed himself yet. Or he's lying on the ground.
You know, he's like a billy goat.
And he's everywhere. He's high, he's low.
Where do you go? And he's like, yeah, he's up on a fire escape. And
it was your turn to watch him.
Did the two of you feel a different type of pressure working on this project, knowing that there were so many fans that have been, you know, dissecting and analyzing these characters and their story for decades?
I mean, I didn't feel any particular pressure because it's we're dealing with different characters, and the characters that are familiar to us are much younger. And to me, it was a good thing to revisit the show, but to revisit it many decades earlier. And I think that kept it from being any kind of pressure situation. And of course, we didn't write it, so you know, we're not responsible for what people are looking for.
Yeah, I felt a bit of pressure, but not because it is such an important show, important piece of television, such an important piece of Americana, it's an important piece of it's one of the first shows that had a great anti-hero. It's one of the first shows that kind of allowed the arrival of peak television, as they call it, of the golden age of television. It kind of put cable on the map, put HBO on the map. It kind of caught the attention of feature filmmakers that were like, wow, television, it can be like a feature film. So that was all in my mind. And then once we started shooting, I kind of just shut it all off. And just, you know, we're making a film. And this is a film that stands alone. And as Bob said, it's a film that's from a completely different time period. And, we want to do something that stands alone. So,
Bob, in your production design, are there any, subtle Easter eggs that you would point out for fans to watch for?
You know, it's funny. People ask about that. And very little that was intentionally in there, but there, I think it's on somewhere in the dining room. There's a photograph of Livia, that we recreated, a photograph that we had of Nancy Marchand from the beginning of season three, where we had Livia's funeral. And, we sort of recreated that with Vera, and you'd really have to be looking to find it, but it's there. And it's a duplicate wedding photo with Vera, who was so amazing. I mean, it's one thing to watch something being filmed and to see scenes and bits and pieces and not necessarily know how things are going to come together, but seeing the finished film, it was just astounding how much she brought Livia to life, and how it seemed like this is exactly what Livia was like when she was younger. I mean, it was astonishing to me. I thought she really just did an amazing job. So that was interesting. I mean, to get young Livia, it's kind of amazing. You know, there were scenes that had been referred to too. The scene where, you know, Johnny, when they're in the convertible, the firing the pistol, that was referenced somewhere I think it was in the episode where they were at the lake house, but it was one of those things that I talked about, like, you know, Chicky Sasso, and like, he shot her right in the beehive hairdo, and those things that were littered through the scripts, and then they came to life. It was really kind of fun.
Any recollections of any conversations or directions with David Chase?
One thing we decided very early on is, I said, please, please, can we not do the plastic slipcovers? I think it was important to us to try and do real Italian American as opposed to cliche Italian American, or that kind of cartoon, or that overly characterized, you know, caricaturized, really. And that was something that we definitely talked about, was, you know, to avoid a lot of those cliches and look for other things that we know were real. I mean, there was a thing about, because of my Italian family on my mother's side, and then certain things that I remembered, that I would ask Regina to find things. And it's like, can you find one of those metal cake dishes that has a lock on it? And she found one, and, you know, a certain kind of sugar bowl. And I don't know that they would mean anything to anyone else, but there were certain things that made it more Italian to me. I mean, funny things people would do, like, you put cookies in a tin, but to line the underside of the tin with aluminum foil so it sealed better when you put the lid on, and all these little funny things like that. And Regina, our decorator, who's amazing, is from Harrison, New Jersey. And the other night we saw the movie, and I said, "Well, thank you for another amazing job." And she said, "This one I lived. This one I knew." You know, Harrison's the next town over from Newark, and she said, I knew this territory very, very well. Well, the only other thing I would say was that in addition to revisiting The Sopranos, it was great for me to revisit working with David Chase and working with Alan Taylor and working with Kramer. Because I had worked with Kramer on Boardwalk Empire and on Too Big to Fail, but not on anything Soprano related. And I think, you know, it's great to work with people that you have a shorthand with, and people that you have trust in, and you know, sometimes there's almost an adversarial relationship between production designers and directors of photography, and you have to know that when someone says, I'm trying to help, I'm trying to support your work, I'm trying to help your work that supports Alan's work, that supports David's vision. And it was great to have all of that, like, in the rearview mirror when we started, and know that, like, it's just great to work with Kramer. And it was, I mean, to me, being able to work with David again after all this time, because I hadn't been production designing as long as I have now when we started the show 20 years ago. And I wasn't the person who did it first. And David was already the famous creator of The Sopranos by the time I ever came into the show. And so I was always very intimidated. And so to sort of work with him again and not be afraid of him was kind of a treat. And, you know, he's one of those people that you know, would follow into battle anytime, you know, and I hope he has some more scripts up his sleeve, because, you know, working with him was a dream, and working with these guys was just like a dream.
Yeah, I'd have to add in, you know, working with David Chase was, you know, kind of working with David Chase was like a great life experience for me. I know I was also intimidated to first meet him. Who is this man who created this amazing show? Is he, you know, as tough as Tony Soprano is? There is a little bit of Tony David Chase in Tony Soprano, and vice versa. And then it became like this great friendship, and he was, you know, he really trusted, trusted us as a team, you know, Alan, Bob Shaw, myself, Amy, the costume designer, to you know, bring about this world that he had created. And he didn't, you know, meddle in sort of like this shot or that shot, but he was sort of like this tone master that we would go to, you know, to make sure that the tone was in the right place. And he would just do very slight adjustments of tone, but he wasn't, you know, out there like saying, why are you doing that shot or something like that. It was more like, you know, really like he was the godfather of the show. And I will, you know, never forget that experience. And I hope that he does have more stories under his sleeve.
Congratulations to both of you. And thanks so much for talking with us about the project.
Thank you.